colors and logo will remain in Seattle to go to a future franchise. As part of the deal, the owners will pay $45 million to buy out the rest of the team's two-year lease. The owners will pay an extra $30 million if Seattle doesn't get a replacement team in the next 5 years. For NPR News, I'm Michael Cross in Stillwater, Oklahoma.
New claims for unemployment insurance rose sharply last week by 16,000 to 404,000. That's the highest it's been since late March. The four-week moving average, which smooths out week-to-week volatility, increased last week to nearly 391,000. Here's the latest from Wall Street. Dow's now up 80 points at 11,295. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, whose four-day poetry festival starts September 25th in Waterloo Village, New Jersey, at dodgepoetryfestival.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. This Saturday's wine tasting lineup includes Winner's Tank Shiraz, Paso a Paso Red, Zoom Zinfandel, and Renard Rosé. Information available at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from the Meredith Foundation, dedicated to supporting the musical arts in performance and presentation.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Michael Weisskopf. He's a senior correspondent for Time magazine. Back in 2003, he was working for Time as a reporter in Iraq. He was embedded with American troops there. And on that day, this was the 10th of December, he was riding through Baghdad in the back of an army Humvee when a grenade flew into the vehicle. He picked it up to toss it back out. It blew up and took off his hand. After that, he spent more than a year in Walter Reed Medical Center in the wing of the hospital that is reserved for amputees. And he tells his story and also the stories of some of the soldiers that he met there in a recent book that we will talk about here on this part of the show. His book is Blood Brothers Among the Soldiers of Ward 57. And that is, Ward 57 is that ward in the military hospital that's reserved for amputees. The book is published by Henry Holt, and I'm sure that you could find it in the bookstore if you would like to take a look at it. Mr. Weisskopf, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's a pleasure. I am well familiar with your station and with Champaign-Urbana, having grown up on the south side of Chicago.
Well, I'm pleased that you could be here on our air. Perhaps just to start, you might tell the story of what happened on that night, December 10th of 2003.
I had been embedded for going on 4 weeks with the 1st Armored Division, and we were on a night patrol. Came out of a labyrinth of streets in Baghdad and pulled through a market. I was in a 3 Humvee convoy in the middle Humvee. We were stopped in front of a mosque, and I heard a thunk and looked to my right and saw a black, shiny object, nothing I recognized, but I lunged for it. I left my seat to get it, picked it up, and it was so hot I could feel the flesh of my hand liquefying. I immediately proceeded to fling it outside the Humvee, and everything went dark for me. I woke up a few seconds later in the bed of the Humvee, and I could tell there had been an explosion, although I didn't hear it. There was a lot of smoke around me and kind of a sense of disarray. I myself was stunned and took a little inventory and raised my right arm and saw there was no hand on it.
Mm. One of the things that you write about in the book is trying to see if you could figure out what had happened, what you had been thinking at the time, because there were a lot of people who said they thought that you were a hero, that you had saved the lives of the people in the vehicle, certainly. And you have wrestled with, and maybe you still are, trying to figure out, well, what exactly did you know what it was? Were you thinking about the fact that you were thinking about anything in particular? Were you thinking about the fact that, oh, I got to get this thing out of here or else we're all dead? Or whether that stuff went through your mind at the time?
My main concern with that whole issue is that I responded instinctively, and there was no kind of cost-benefit analysis involved. I didn't have time for that. And in my book, heroes are those who make conscious decisions to sacrifice themselves at for the benefit of others. There are many of them in our history. Audie Murphy was a World War II hero who sort of always was important to me. But others, Mahatma Gandhi, others who sacrificed themselves for political purposes. In any case, I hadn't gone through that kind of conscious decision-making, just responded instinctively. And then I also questioned what made me respond instinctively. Was it... was it a lark? Did I think I was picking up a rock, for instance? Kids, Baghdad kids would pelt us with rocks as we passed through their streets. Or did I know it was a danger? In other words, what underlied my motivation? And so it troubled me because within an hour or two of my injury, I was already being hailed as a hero because I had saved everyone in that Humvee. There were four soldiers and a photographer, and of course myself. And so I wrestled. At first it was an annoyance because I was in so much pain and disarray, I didn't really hear it. But later on, it became a bit of an annoyance.
You ended up in this military hospital in this ward where they specialized in taking care of amputees. And as I understand it, no reporter, no journalist had ever been treated there before. That was all for soldiers. How is it that you ended up going there at all?
No reporter ever wounded in combat had ever been taken there. There's a distinction because certainly reporters who had served in the military and years later as veterans were reporters and they went back there and were treated. I got in there because first of all, it came to my attention because there was a fairly famed hand surgeon there. My sister identified, and the question was how to get in there because it is a hospital reserved for the Army, basically, discover that you need a special exception granted by the Secretary of the Army, and my efforts sort of reached the acting secretary then, primarily because I had some publicity and he decided, evaluated, and decided that I was worthy because I had helped soldiers.
Mm. And do you think that also it was in his mind or someone's mind there in the military that this might be good public relations for the military?
I don't think they operate that way, truly. They're not savvy enough to make it. If they had rejected me, they wouldn't have gotten a black eye out of it, I'm sure, and they certainly got nothing favorable from it by admitting me.
How many other soldiers have, just soldiers who have been wounded in Iraq, have passed through Ward 57?
Just in Iraq, there have been over 500. Ward 57 is known as Amputee Alley, and it probably is the kind of signature venue for this war simply because of the fact that amputees are quite visible, and they've drawn a lot of attention.
There one thing that separates this war from others has to do with a combination of improvements in combat medicine, the fact that soldiers are wearing body armor, the fact that they can get people help quickly right there on the scene and then get them to places where they can get sophisticated medical attention. People don't bleed to death anymore like they did in past wars. And so what this all means is that people with very serious injuries that in past wars no doubt would have died survive.
Yes, that and the odd configuration or geography of this war where the battlefield is really reduced to a few square miles, and our troops don't have to be so widely allocated. In Vietnam, in those vast jungles, three or four guys would go off in one direction, one would get wounded, and there wouldn't be a medic around him for miles. And in this war, everybody travels in tight convoys, and there's always a medic aboard, so that if somebody gets hurt, the medic generally needs only to hop over from another Humvee to apply a tourniquet. There have also been some technological changes, including better tourniquets, but there are now chemicals to throw on open wounds to stop the bleeding, and something called quick clot, for one.
I guess my understanding that previously Ward 57 was they dealt, what was it, orthopedic patients? It was not until the run up to Iraq and the expectation of the military that they would have these kinds of people. It was not a specialty ward for amputees.
It was a orthopedic ward, and we have to remember that amputation is a very rare species in this country. There are probably fewer than 100,000, 150,000 a year in this vast country we're in. And so they are often the result of occupational injury as well as traffic accidents. But so, yes, that's right. This Ward 57 could have been a place where an amputee could have recovered, but it was primarily a orthopedic ward, and it was inhabited generally by the elderly people with knee problems and back problems.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, just let me introduce again Michael Weisskopf. He's a senior correspondent for Time magazine. He's the author of the book Blood Brothers, Among the Soldiers of Ward 57, published by Henry Holt. That it's about his experiences and the experiences of some other soldiers on this ward in Walter Reed Hospital, that is specifically for to treat, to help amputees, people who were injured in the war. He himself was an embedded reporter in Iraq in 2003 when he was riding in an Army Humvee and a grenade came into the vehicle. He picked it up to toss it back out. It did blow up. It took off his hand, but also by doing that, he ended up saving his life and the lives of the other people that were riding in the vehicle. And again, the book is about his experiences and particularly about three other soldiers that were there on Ward 57 when he was there. Again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to bring into the conversation, so we'll do that. Someone who is listening in Urbana in line one. Hello.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if you knew anything about who or what sources the Doonesbury cartoon uses to inform its comic strip about the experience of BD, the character who was wounded and suffers post-traumatic shock.
The cartoonist Gary Trudeau is a friend of mine, and he has spent long periods of time on Ward 57 getting to know amputees. It's not based on any specific person, of course, but it's a kind of composite, I would guess, of characters he's met there in the many years he's come back and forth.
Well, your explanation almost makes this question redundant. It struck me that the comic strip was, insofar as it was talking about the experience of wounded and recovering veterans, has been a very useful and long-term source of information. What do you think?
It's helped popularize the problems of amputees, and it's a fairly secret world otherwise, and it's done a great service. He has, by the way, published his strips in a couple paperback books, which are available. And I think it's been a wonderful service. It's very serious stuff he does. It's well received on Ward 57 and among the staff there, so it's really pretty terrific.
Well, I really felt that as a veteran, but not a combat veteran, that it really had a lot of the qualities of the Willie and Joe cartoons and the more authentic things that have been done at times. Thank you.
Welcome.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Others are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. That gets a question that I certainly wanted to ask you, and that is, I think that a lot of people would argue that this is one aspect of the Iraq War that's really been undercovered. That is, we have had stories about people being killed. Those people have been memorialized by their families and their communities, and we have had some stories about that. But I think that there hasn't been as much reporting about how it is, what happens to people when they're profoundly wounded, and how it is that they work to try to recover and get back to life as much as they can get back to life.
Yes, and I wrote the book in part to draw attention to this, not only the actual wounds and how it occurred. Almost probably 90% of the book takes place outside of Iraq, and the idea is to explain the recovery process and, more importantly, the reentry process. It's complicated. There are huge psychological adjustments that are required. The relationship between families shifts, and it's quite a loss to lose a limb. It is of the many losses we face in life, serious disease, of loss of family members, loss of career, loss of freedom for some people. Losing a limb is right up there. It takes a mammoth adjustment, and the idea is to write about that and to write about this triumphs, and there are many triumphs among the people I write. And the trips, the falls.
Mm. Did, before you went on this particular reporting trip, how much had you thought about the possibility that you could be injured or even killed?
I took the assignment at the early phases of the insurgency. The insurgency had begun to take a bite and perfected these roadside bombs or improvised explosive devices. And these IEDs were claiming a Humvee a day, different parts of Iraq, for a number of weeks. And I think a couple of contractors were also blown up in a car on the way home from work by one of these devices. And so there was a lingering thought of risk, but it didn't seem to be a compelling, overwhelming risk.
You would have been unlike most, I think probably most everybody else that was there to be treated, first of all, because they were soldiers and you were a reporter, also because you were a lot older than they were, had sort of different kind of life experience. How do you think that somehow for you made this experience different, or when you're dealing with the loss of a limb, does all that other stuff, what might be different, in a sense, just melt away, and the fundamental challenges you deal with, everybody's dealing with the same fundamental challenges, and then in a sense that, you know, that erases differences?
I'll answer two ways. As a kind of a resident of Amputee Alley, I think the distinctions melted away, even though I was twice the age of these guys and from a different world altogether. They saw me in the same light, and I blended in pretty well. And in that sense, distinctions break down. Ward 57 knew no age, no rank, no economic level, no education level. It was just gimps trying to get through another day of pain and loss of identity. Now, on a personal level, I do think it affected me differently. For one, I had a years of career behind me, and I had a kind of fixed position career-wise. Many of the kids who were hurt went into the Army because they saw it as a career, and either they tired of school or they were in dead-end jobs, or they wanted to serve and saw in the Army a great mission. And for them, suddenly, they were looking into the abyss. They didn't have anything to go to. I knew I'd have a career in some fashion, albeit with one hand, to go back to. I also had a family, and many of these young service people are sort of so young that they are still unconnected. They still don't have wives or husbands or kids, and of course, losing a limb like this so changes your identity and how you're perceived by others that there is great fear that you won't be loved and things like that. I was able to avoid that.
Yeah. So you were literally old enough to be the dad of some of these guys, right?
Yes. Yeah. Certainly.
You could. I think you would not be surprised. One would not be surprised that among the many things that people who had lost a limb in combat or more than one would be feeling, that the big thing that they'd be feeling would be anger. They would be really angry at, and I'm not exactly sure at who. They would be angry at the military. They would be angry at the president. They would be angry at God. They would be angry at the enemy. I don't know. I wonder what your experience was with the kind of emotional reaction that people had, and did in fact, was that in fact one of the things that people really had to struggle with, just being so absolutely furious at the feeling of injustice about what had happened to them?
Yes, and I think it was more anger at their situation and the fact probably, and I don't know how many of them could verbalize this, but to be hit in a passive way. They don't see the eyes of their enemies in this war. They're often hit on the way to work, basically, in a Humvee as they're driving along, and some idiot 100 yards away pushes a remote controlled button, which detonates a bomb. And so they're not really fighting. I think that gives them a sense of frustration and anger. It compounds the anger. And yes, they are. They don't direct the anger generally at the president or at the policy or at the military. They're angry that they're not in the position, you know, to serve in a way they did. They miss their comrades. They miss the mission badly. They miss the idea of serving. But there is anger. Everybody who goes through a loss like that has it. It is one of the stages. There's also denial. There's also frustration and eventually kind of reconciliation.
Mm. Was there much discussion, or was there any discussion of politics?
Very little. I think when I was there, which was at the end of 03, 04, and I stayed there, by the way, for about 18 months as an outpatient, continuing. I live in D.C., so I could be released from the hospital after a number of weeks and still come back there on a daily basis as an outpatient for wound care, for physical therapy, occupational therapy, prosthetic adjustments, and all that stuff. But it was at a time when the war was not as seemingly hopeless and as divisive as it is today. And even so, I think that there wasn't really much politicking going on, because most of these guys sort of make up their mind to serve and not to question policy in that sense. And many of them felt later on, I continue to go back there on a regular basis, I began to feel later on that they are being abandoned because of the protests and because of the divisions caused and some of the president's opposition. But on the whole, there is such a camaraderie that's based on soldiering, not on politics.
We're at our midpoint here again. Let me reintroduce the guest, Michael Weisskopf. He's a senior correspondent for Time magazine. He's a Pulitzer Prize finalist, winner of the George Polk Award, also the Goldsmith Award for Investigative Reporting, the National Headliners Award, the Daniel Pearl Award for Courage and Integrity in Journalism. He makes his home in Washington, D.C., and he is the author of the book Blood Brothers, Among the Soldiers of Ward 57. It's published by Henry Holt. Talks about his experiences after he was wounded when he was a reporter covering the war in Iraq for Time magazine. He lost his right hand and spent time as both an inpatient and outpatient at Walter Reed Medical Center, Ward 57, which is the place where they specialize in treating people who are, have amputations. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, here's another. Someone who is listening wants to join in the conversation. Line 1 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is perhaps tangential, but I'm rather interested in your opinion of the Humvee as a military weapon or vehicle. I think there's been some criticism of it, and apparently the Army is now looking for a replacement. Did it maneuverability or usability outbalance its lack of armor? Or don't you have an opinion on that?
Oh, I can make one, I guess. I found it was a pretty maneuverable vehicle, and actually the one I was in didn't have a cover. I was in a what's known as a high-back Humvee. It was used to transport troops and cargo. And giving an idea of how early this was in the insurgency, troops were still carried in that fashion. It was like the back of a pickup truck, and that's where I was when the grenade came in. I wasn't in a covered Humvee in that sense. There was a cab, of course, to this one. They are maneuverable. I don't think the problem is with the Humvee so much as it is with the weapon that's being used. It'd be very hard to have an impregnable vehicle that could still move and be affordable in terms of gasoline and fuel. I think it, and as we have up-armored, the insurgency has increased the power of its explosives. So it's a really kind of a cat-and-mouse game.
Of course, the fuel consumption is not only a matter of cost, but it's also a matter of range. If you increase the weight too much, you reduce the range of the vehicle to the point where it's not effective, I suppose.
Yes, I think that's true. And the gas, the fuel also is, of course, a source of explosives. So,
very true.
And it, I just returned from a burn center for our soldiers, and many of them, of course, caught fire because fuel tanks exploded.
Yes, as I recall, they used to carry extra gas on the back of tanks, but then jettison it before they actually went into combat.
Yes.
40 years ago, I guess, now. But
okay.
Well, best wishes, and I appreciate your opinion.
Thanks for the call. Maybe we, I certainly want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about the three soldiers in particular that you profile in the book that you follow, Pete Damon, Luis Rodriguez, and Bobby Isaacs. People can obviously go and get the full story here, but I want to make sure that we mention them and I give you a chance to talk some about them.
These were guys I had met in various phases of my recovery at Walter Reed. They were not with me in Iraq. They were all injured within 6 weeks of me. They were interesting to me I had many friends there, of course, but they were interesting to me because of the differences they were from me, and their wounds were different. Pete Damon, from Brockton, Mass., tough working-class town. Pete left high school at the age of 15 to work with his hands, joined the National Guard in Massachusetts to get a marketable skill, and became an aviation mechanic. And while he was changing the tire on a Black Hawk helicopter, because of some kind of a lack of safety equipment, the tire exploded and ripped off both of his hands. This was a guy who had not only made a living with his hands back in Brockton, but also had to fight with those hands to defend himself. He found himself suddenly without hands. When he landed in Walter Reed, had a very profound adjustment because he wasn't able to do a thing for himself, couldn't feed, clothe, bathe himself, even clean up after the toilet. And his story of recovery is heroic. It is just extraordinary, and how he reentered, taught himself not only how to write, but to draw, to sketch, and has just recently opened up a gallery in outside of Boston to sell some of his own art, handless art. This is, does this with a hook on a non-dominant hand. It's just an amazing story. The other guys, Luis Rodriguez from a slum outside of San Juan, always wanted to be a medic and became one, and was a real lion of a medic, led a platoon of medics up the desert in Iraq, went to Mosul, in northern Iraq, and was injured by an IED, lost his leg above his knee, and also lost, really, he thought, the only thing he ever wanted to be, which was a medic. And he ended up wanting to serve so badly, stayed in the military, in the Army, and ended up becoming a big-time famous medic who ended up leading a school, a fairly famous medic school at Fort Campbell, and now travels the country as kind of an evangelical medic to help other divisions of the Army. Bobby Isaac, quintessential Southern kid from rural North Carolina, loved to chew tobacco and soup up cars, was from a religious home, but a very conservative religious home, but had a real kind of wild streak in him, and joined the Army right after 9/11, and saw it as a perfect synthesis of mission and of adventure, and loved the Army, and lost both legs to an IED, and ended up going back to his community and taking a spot as a community figure.
Hmm. Well, I got another call here to bring in. Why don't we do that? Farina is the place, line number 4, toll-free line.
Hi.
Hello? Yes.
Hi. This is just excellent. It's pretty obvious that to people who pay attention that the wounded are a huge, huge story. And my compliments to you, and I'm so sorry for your wounds. How in the heck did you live through that? Why weren't you blinded? Also, I mean, it's a miracle that you weren't killed. Also, Mike, another question. Where do all these explosives come from, and aren't they expensive? Okay, I'll go off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
The explosives initially came from stockpiles, which Saddam cleverly left all over the country. And so one of the little told stories of this war is that we had such a scarcity of troops at the beginning of the war that we couldn't secure those arms depots, and they fell in the hands of former Baathists, when Jerry Bremer, the first the head of the provisional authority there, fired all of the got rid of the entire military under Saddam. Many of them knew where the weapons were too, and seized them, brought them home, hid them, and so a lot of the explosives came from there. And the rest has been over the years financed by Baathists, and come out of Iran, come out of Syria. Al Qaeda's people also bring it in. And so there's no shortage of stuff to be used against us. But the initial burst, probably the stuff used against me, was just hanging around. I wasn't blind, I wasn't killed, because I fortunately acted quickly enough to at least get the grenade away from me. And the closest thing to the grenade was my hand, which just was blown to smithereens. But the grenade was at that point probably a few inches from my hand, outside the Humvee, and it did some damage through shrapnel, which is a kind of crazy, explosion of metal parts and whacked me quite a bit on the backside and on the legs, and ended up injuring the photographer and a couple of the soldiers, but not that seriously.
Was this a rocket-propelled grenade?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think it. For instance, it didn't. I would assume a rocket-propelled grenade would have ricocheted all over the Humvee. I heard it come in. It smacked against the armor behind me, and appeared at that point to rest on the bench next to me. So it was lucky, because otherwise nobody would have been able to get hold of it before it exploded. Yeah.
So this is the kind of thing that people think of when you think of a grenade. It's a hand. It's a handheld thing. It's got a pin. You pull the pin. You throw
yeah.
it.
Yes. However, it was a homemade deal. Many of them are. So you don't. It's not recognizable. It doesn't look like a pineapple, for instance, which our grenades look like. It doesn't look like the Russian grenades or the German grenades. It's just you take some metal casing, stick some gunpowder in there and some metal shards, and you put a fuse on it, light it, and toss it. It does a lot of damage.
Let's talk with someone else. This is a caller in Champaign, line one.
Yes, this is very interesting, David. And I kind of want to go back to a follow-up question David asked. Was there any political talk at Walter Reed or anywhere else among amputees? I had a sergeant major in the United States Army who was a cousin of mine, recently retired after 31 years, and was detailed to the Pentagon. And almost every day or every other day, he'd go over to Walter Reed to visit the amputees. And that soured him so much, their condition soured him against the Iraq War, which he before then vigorously supported. He began to think it was just a waste of human beings, and these young men and women who were in this horrific condition led him to question whether the cost of this war eclipse the benefits. Have you had those thoughts?
I had a very strong emotional reaction like that, and I was a supporter initially of the invasion on the basis of the intelligence we were told was ironclad. Everyone knows that war has an ugly face. It's another thing to wake up to it every morning, as I did.
Yeah, I believe General William Tecumseh Sherman once said, "War is hell."
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you see the wreckage of it all around you, it makes you question what is being gained by it. I was in Iraq at the at its liberation, and it was an amazing moment to be there to see young Iraqis taste freedom for the first time, and the exhilaration that came from that. But I was also in Walter Reed one day when a young soldier by the name of James Fair, a specialist who had been both blinded and stripped of both hands from a bomb that exploded in his face, was wheeled in. And James's wife was pregnant, he was having some brain injury, and he was being brought into one of the therapy wards to be tested for a sensory reactions, and I got really physically ill from it, because his eyes had been gouged out, his head was stapled up, his face was badly injured, and his hands were gone. I thought, what a cruel injury. Not only is he blinded, but he doesn't have hands for braille or for to carry a cane. And so it was at that point that I thought that a day of freedom for Iraqi youth wasn't worth a lifetime of darkness for James Fair.
Yeah. And then in another context, I have a friend who lost his arm by way of IED?
Right.
IED in Iraq, and he remained very supportive of the war effort even after he went through his therapy at Walter Reed and was dismissed. But then his anger turned toward VA because of how they were very lax, and he thought inefficient in processing his claim for disability. And then I just read the president's proposed budget, which also cuts money or proposes to cut money for the Veterans Administration. I just really, I'm at cross purposes as to what this all means when these guys like you make the supreme sacrifice and then the Veterans Administration sort of leaves them out to dry, for lack of a better term.
Well, I don't get any, I'm not involved with the VA since I'm not a veteran, but I am aware of the frustrations many of these guys have, and I can tell you that that many of my my fellow amputees, or almost all of them, are continue to be supportive of the mission in Iraq because when you lose a part of your body, you want to feel that the cause was a valid one. So they go on and think and believe that they did something important, and they believe that regardless of the outcome, through their efforts, we toppled a dictator who had killed 500,000 of his own people and opened up the country to elections for the first time in 50 years. And so I think that those are important milestones. And yes, they're frustrated by the VA. No, there's nothing new about that.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for the call. Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580. His name is Michael Weisskopf. He's a reporter. He's a journalist. He's a senior correspondent for Time magazine. He is the author of the book Blood Brothers, Among the Soldiers of Ward 57. It's published by Henry Holt. And it tells his own story and the story of some other soldiers that he got to know that were there being taken care of in Ward 57 at Walter Reed Medical Center. That's the wing of the Armed Forces Hospital that's reserved for amputees. His own story was that he was working as a reporter for Time. He was embedded with some Army troops in 2003. They were riding through Baghdad in the back of a Humvee, and a grenade came into the vehicle. He picked it up to toss it back out. It exploded and took off his right hand. And after that, he spent a lot of time at Walter Reed, some as an inpatient, some also as an outpatient, taking care of and learning to deal with his injury. And as I say, the story in the book also is the story of particularly of these three other soldiers, Pete Damon, Luis Rodriguez, and Bobby Isaacs, that he got to know and that he writes about. And I think, I guess I want to make sure that people know, or I wanted to say, that Blood Brothers really isn't a political book. And I kind of think that the closest thing in there to a political statement is that story about how the president came calling one day and you decided that you didn't want to meet him.
Yeah, but that wasn't for politics by any means. It's your reporters are independent observers, and the president was coming to thank troops for their sacrifice. And you know, they really worked for him, and they looked to him as a boss, and they were really fulfilling his policy. I was there for totally independent reasons, and it didn't seem right to be part of that kind of an effort. I didn't want to take time away from people really who should have been there, and also I didn't want to be part of a what would obviously be a publicity effort by the president to showcase his compassion and to loop around between policy and sacrifice. And it seemed to be inappropriate. It wasn't a question of a political position.
Hmm. Okay. Let's talk with some other folks here. Urbana, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I have kind of a political question. Ambassador Bremer, who is seems to me was had big responsibility in the composition of the new government, has now been named, what, Assistant Secretary of State, to go back there with a new change in course. And I was wondering about your opinion on this. Thank you.
When the story of this, the history of this has been told, I think Bremer will come in for a great deal of criticism. I think he mishandled much of this. There have been other books which have focused on his management and mismanagement. I was there when he, for instance, cashiered all of the military, and I think that was a dreadful decision.
If you wouldn't mind talking a little bit more about yourself, I'm interested in having you talk, if you can, about what it means to lose your right hand. This was the hand you wrote with, and I'm assuming you're right-handed, that you know you do everything with it, and people should just pause for a moment to think about all the things that they do in their day with their right hand and what it would be like if you didn't have one.
Nobody can imagine it, really, or even bother to think about it until they lose it. And it's the hand is a remarkable instrument. It curves and pulls and pushes and bends and gets in all kinds of contortions to get to do things for you. And I'm, of course, a reporter. I had scribbled for 30 years to earn a living. I also use that hand to make peanut butter sandwiches for my young kids. I was then a single dad. And to chauffeur them to school in the morning and to wash their clothing. So it was pretty important. And you can get by with one hand, but it's no substitute for having two. There are many, many things you need two hands for, everything from sweeping a floor with a broom, can't do that with one hand, or shoveling snow, you can relate to that in Urbana, to putting a tie on. You can't really pull a tie on with one hand. And so it's a terrible loss. This was a hand, after all, that I touched the cheeks of my kids with when they're babies, and I threw a pretty good curveball with. So it was an enormous loss.
You have a prosthesis?
I do.
Now, does that some of those things? I guess that means you can't do. How much of what you could do before can you pretty much still do?
I manage to do just about everything, often with great effort or with adjustments. For instance, I no longer type. I use a voice recognition software, which I find to be fast and pretty effective. I do drive. I continue to drive. I continue to do everything. But I have a new baby, and it's very hard, for instance, to pick up a baby with a hook. And she'll let me know when I do. But I, after all, am in a much better position than my friend Pete Damon, who has no hands. Hmm. What he had to go through was extraordinary, to learn how to put a pair of pants on. You know, he had to buy sizes, a couple sizes too big, so he could put them on his bed, wiggle into them. First, he would zip up the zipper with his teeth, and then he would wiggle them on. And he'd have a belt, which with his stumps he was able to adjust to make them tight. And then he'd finally get a pair of pants on. And it could take him 20 minutes. It was just extraordinary what he had to go through. In any case, the prostheses do give you some capability. They're very uncomfortable. They're awkward. Many soldiers, many friends of mine, just avoid them altogether.
When you have this kind of disability, do you and you're around other people who also have been disabled sort of in a similar way, although everybody's different, do you, I guess I would imagine it might be that you would say, well, okay, so I'm pretty bad off, but there's some guy that's worse. Or is it so much that you're just really thinking about, you have to be thinking about yourself, your situation, and thinking about, okay, what am I going to do now? How am I going to deal with this? How am I going to learn to take care of myself? What's my life going to be like? And you don't spend time thinking about the fact that it actually could be worse.
I think you do. You do tend to adjust to whatever your injury is and do the best you can and move on with your life. And there are daily reminders and probably hourly reminders of your handicap, not to mention the kind of dealing with a public that's curious and often rude about these things. Kids are naturally inquisitive and ask questions which can be uncomfortable for certain people. But you do, and yes, you do think that you're, when you're back functioning, you see somebody else who's handicapped, you think, oh, that poor person.
Yeah. How generally, you talked, for example, we're talking a little bit about Pete Damon. This was the guy who was the mechanic who was inflating the helicopter tire when it blew up and he lost both of his arms. Luis Rodriguez, he was the guy who was the medic who lost one leg and parts of
fingers,
a couple of
yeah.
fingers. And Bobby Isaacs, he was the guy who was an IED blew up and took off both legs or parts of both legs. How are they doing?
Very well. I mentioned earlier Pete has opened a gallery. He took money which was appropriated by the Congress for those with serious injuries in this war. He took it and bought an old building, rehabbed it, and opened this art gallery. And it's just extraordinary to see the work of a person who has no hands. And he also contains, this gallery contains, the art of local artists, Middleboro, Massachusetts. Rodriguez is doing extremely well. He gets invitations from all over the country to speak about medics, and he is an inspiration to medics. Bobby Isaacs is in North Carolina. He is studying to become a gunsmith. He was married. He has a nice little house, and is an active member of his congregation, the Liberty Baptist Church, a fundamentalist Baptist church, and in that sense has kind of picked up a role for himself, and a prominent role, which may have been expected.
Are they atypical? I mean, have you picked guys who actually have done pretty well, and are there people you could say that just don't make it at all? Or generally speaking, do most people come through these injuries as well as, you know, actually pretty well, you would have to say?
I picked guys, by the way, because I picked them early in the process because they were friends of mine and they were open. They could open up to me. And I didn't know at the time we started working together what the outcomes would be. And they have done quite well, as I would say the vast majority of amputees. There are guys, one I know, for instance, who has a crack habit and blew his money the Congress gave him, and he's had some criminal problems. Another amputee who's had been accused of some spousal abuse. But on the whole, and I should say the larger whole, these are guys who saw their injury as an opportunity to continue living and to continue living large.
Yeah, we're going to leave it there. The book, if you want to read it, Blood Brothers Among the Soldiers of Ward 57, published by Henry Holt, by our guest, Michael Weisskopf. He's a senior correspondent for Time. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to WILL.UIUC.EDU. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
WILL programming is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. With the Summer Studio Theater Company's repertory season of Tally's Folly, The Last 5 Years, The Turn of the Screw, and special performances of Abraham Lincoln Walks at Midnight, currently playing in the Studio Theater.
It's 2 minutes before noon Central Time. Good morning. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frayne is our technical director. Coming up this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, ahead of Independence Day, we'll get a glimpse of America's history through the lens of women's letters. We'll rebroadcast an interview with Lisa Grunwald, co-editor of Women's Letters, America from the Revolutionary War to the Present. That will follow the 1 o'clock news. Coming up during the noon hour, Ed Kieser will share his forecast for the holiday weekend, then we'll have this week's Talk to Ed. Let's take a look now at what's happening in Kansas City and in Chicago 1 minute before the close today, ahead of the holiday. July wheat in Kansas City is trading at 891. That is up 6.5. September 903, down 1.75. In Chicago, July wheat, 866 and three quarters, up 1.5. September, 884.5, up 4.25. July corn, 737.75, down 11. September, 750.25, down 10.75. December, 769.5, down 11. March, 786.75, down 11. July beans, 1649.5, up 3.75. August, 1641, up 1.5. September, 1630.5, down 1.5. November, 1624.25, down 5.75. July meal, 446.80, up $3. July oil, 67.05, that down 72. At the Merck in Chicago, August live cattle.